and welcome to episode 22 of this podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and my co-host, as always, the one and only David Grigg. Hello, David.
The one and only. That's interesting. Yes, I have a story about that, but it's probably too long to tell. There are quite a few David Griggs in the world, so there's not just the one and only. But I'm pleased to be here, Perry.
So, oh, that's good to know.
Thank you.
This week, David, as mentioned at the end of our episode last time, we have a full interview with three science fiction fans from Melbourne. These three fans got together back in the mid-1970s, just prior to AussieCon, held in August 1975 in Melbourne. These three fans got together to work on to create a small genre press, probably the first of its type in Australia. Their aim was to publish science fiction and science fiction related books, and they were attempting to get their first publication out for AussieCon, which they succeeded in doing, but you'll find that there were a few problems along the way. Now, those three people were, or are, Rob Durand, Bruce Gillespie, and Kerry Hanfield. David and I met up with them at Bruce's place and interviewed them about the press, what it was about, and what sort of work they did. So before we get really started on the whole story of the press, how it came to be, what it did, why it was there, I've got one major question for you up front. How do you pronounce it?
In Australia.
It's short for Old North Australia from
Cordwainer Smith,
and it is Strain. And what I found out is that either he was involved in, or might even have suggested, Paul Leinbarger might even have suggested Strain to Professor Afabek Lauder, who was a colleague of his when Leinbarger was in Canberra in the early 60s.
The difficulty you've got is, of course, that it's not spelt with the A in the North Australia. It's spelt with an I, as in Australia. But you pronounce it with an A.
Yeah. No, because with an I.
Right. With Australia. An I, well, it's North Australia.
Australia. Not Australia, but Australia. The long I.
Yeah, but you're right. The A is there.
Not in the spelling.
In the spelling.
So early on, Kerry, you mentioned that you were one of the original two, and we actually have three here, which sort of gives me an indication that there was a bit of a progress that went on from the very beginning.
There was, and the way it started, Bruce had been publishing SF commentary for a number of years. In particular, he had a lot of articles on Philip K. Dick. He was talking that really he would like to do a republishing of those articles, and I and my new thing, he's saying, oh, we can't do it and how hard it's going to be. And I said, look, let's start a publishing company. Let's do the initial was going to be a series of best of SF commentaries. So we chose a title, Philip K. Dick, the Electric Shepherd, and I went about organising the production side of things. And as part of getting that going, in the early stages, we got a number of fans to invest in some money in the press. At the time, our biggest investor was Rob Durand. A couple of years down the track, we brought Rob in as a third partner because of his investments.
Okay.
Well, so, can I go back even further than that?
Oh, yeah, certainly.
This actually started out of the conversation with Kerry, and I said, wish there was some way to finance SF commentary. Mm. And Kerry said, I've thought of a way. Now, it never, ever turned money back to SF commentary in particular, but because I was able, this will come out later, I was able to do typesetting for them. It actually was a great help. So that was the original, and then we started Ideas for Books.
Yes.
And my feeling was it should be more like Advent Publishers in America, that was which had done the Damon Knight collection, the James Blish collection. So we do collection of critical studies. That was the original idea.
But at the time, after the first book, The Electric Shepherd, our second book came out of the Writers' Workshop, which was with Ursula Gwynn in 1975. And that was such a great experience that a lot of people at the workshop said, look, really, we should celebrate this. We should have a book. Australia Press got involved. We got Lee Hart in.
Lee was the one who suggested the book and then really did a lot of the hard work.
A lot of the hard work.
Yeah.
So going back a bit to the very beginning,
And yes, Rob, we will bring you in a little bit later. But going back to the very beginning, you mentioned Advent Press. At the time that you were looking at doing this, so we're talking 74,
75? Yeah,
is that about right?
End of 74.
There, am I right in thinking there weren't any real small publishing houses in Australia? Certainly not in the SF field.
Not in science fiction. The other inspiration for us was our friends Anne and Al from Highland House, who were certainly interested in science fiction, and they just what they'd done is left Methuen, Castle Australia was sinking, so they left that and set up their own small press as one of the first Australian small publishers.
Highland House,
because they started in Highland Street, South Yarra, and there was Anne Godd and Al Knight. And they made quite a fist of that through the 70s and 80s. Yes. But they were inspiration, a local company which was doing what we would like to do.
So they were part of your model?
Part of the model, yes.
They helped distribute us initially, didn't
they? Oh, yeah, of course, yes. But they put us onto the original distributor.
Yeah.
Yes, they
shared it. That's right.
They were very friendly.
Can I ask, was it planned right from the start that you would actually create a publishing company? When did you come up with the name Australia Press?
At the beginning.
At the start, yes. Look.
Because it was in there. John Foyster had done Australia News. Mm. Well, we all had. I found a list today of about five different editors. Of that was the great, the Finnish newspaper of the early 70s. And John Foyster was the great Cordwainer Smith fan, even more than I was. Mm. So there was always that inspiration. And then we wrote to Genevieve Leinbarger, who was Paul Leinbarger's widow, and she gave permission to use the name.
Mm-hmm. And we're off and running.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
So started in end of 74
yes.
with the idea of getting the first publication ready for
AussieCon.
Everything was centred around AussieCon. Mm. There's so many projects and ideas, and it was just the centre of excitement. And that's why Lee Edmonds is trying to make it that... The focus of his history of Australian fandom.
Everything led up to 1975. Yes, yes. And so you actually had copies of the book available in 1975?
I'll tell you the story.
Basically, we chose a printer who was not really a science fiction fan, but really from science fiction. He was based in Montague, and he was doing the program book for AussieCon, and he came to us, or we went to him, and he said, look, I can give you a really good price on your Electric Shepherd. However, to get the good price, he said, it has to be this shape. Right from the start, that was a real bit of a bugbear. We went along with him, and I'm not sure how much it saved us, but over the years, we had complaint after complaint from bookshops because of the odd shape. It was very hard to fit on the bookshelf.
But it was almost square, wasn't it?
Almost square.
It stuck out from any shelf.
Yeah. Yeah. And we had issues with timing. It was meant to be ready for AussieCon in 1975. It was, but we only had copies about two or three days before the convention.
Yeah.
And not only that, the same with the AussieCon program book. In fact...
Weren't half the program books wrongly printed?
Well, they had binding problems. Yeah.
I should say that the AussieCon program book was about the size of a sort of a largish paperback.
Yes.
They were notorious for basically having the cover come off the binding.
Yeah, they were.
Then all of the inside of the glue just disintegrated over the years. Getting a pristine copy of that is fairly difficult. As I recall, though, the Electric Shepherd, when it came out, did actually have far better binding and glue.
It held together. It was well produced.
Yeah.
Still holds up today.
Yeah.
It was a success, although we're expecting to get a huge number of sales at the convention. We didn't get that.
Yeah, of course.
We got a small number, but I think we'd be a bit naive in that regard. But over the years, it sold out through bookshops and direct sales.
Well, it's still the only book that we keep getting requests for, and we have to say we can't supply it. So it's finally ran out of copies.
So that was 1975 with Electric Shepherd, which was an anthology of articles
from SF Commentary about Philip K. Dick, including the famous Stanislaw Lem SF A Hopeless Case with Exceptions, which was set off this huge debate in America. And,
This is when the SFWA threw him out, isn't it? I have a feeling that Ursula Le Guin resigned from the SFWA.
Oh, yeah, she was a strong defender of Lem.
So you cause ructions all the way through the
genre. The essence of the article was then taken up by Lem, did a new article for SF Studies in 75, which it was even stronger in condemning the entire American SF. So they did not like it.
No, they don't, it doesn't work very well for them. So that one was the first one, and then, as you mentioned earlier, The Altered Eye, edited by Lee Harding, was the second one. These were stories that came from the Writers' Workshop in 75.
Some of them were ones written for the workshop as entry stories, such as Philippa Madden's.
And some were produced during the workshop.
Yes.
But I think the thing that I really like about it and makes it different, it was also talking about the workshop experience. Yes. So it wasn't just straight an anthology of stories. So, and I remember, I think one of the initial articles, I think, was Randall Flynn, titled Stabbed Alive, and he was the first person up at the workshop in terms of having his story workshop, and he went through his experience. And the rest of the book had similar things like that. So really, you get the experience of being at the workshop and what it was like. Well, you were there.
There's an article by me. And so, it was really about that experience of, My article was about writing the love story. You know, go write a love story. Oh, my God.
Thanks for that.
We were all pretty young then.
We were. It was tough work.
And the other one, they had various exercises. And one was, I think, you had to pick a noun and adjective out of a hat and make a story. And it's an amazing story. Like, one was a broken pitch and the other was healing orgy.
So, Rob, we're into the second year of Australia Press, and you're on board by this stage? When did you sort of become a partner in the business?
Well, let me go back a bit. I discovered fandom through seeing a tiny ad in the Saturday Age for Australian Science Fiction Review, which, and then I got after the first or second issue, and so I got to meet John Bankston, and then Forster and everybody else. And I became assistant editor of that for a little while. And when I knew that sort of all the stuff we'd moved over to Bruce when John finished editing ASFR and Bruce took over as SF Commentary and inherited some of like George Turner's reviews and what have you. So I knew that Bruce, with Carey's help, was putting together Philip K. Dick Electric Shepherd, and I was an investor in it. I went to the Writers' Workshop, which was a fantastic experience. And when Lee Harding offered to edit the book. In fact, I did 95% of the editing of it. And he said, you should be co-editor. And I said, no. So he's put in the preface. And thanks to Rob Gerard who helped mightily in the end or something. But I did all the copy editing. I wrote the all the linking pieces between the things. I made sure people like David and everybody else wrote their little contributions.
So you cracked the whip over David Grigg to make sure he got...
And it was a really good book. Almost everything in it had been written at the workshop, but I think, as you say, Philip
was probably... that was her entry thing.
And Ursula had a story too, which...
Yes.
Which I can't remember whether she workshopped it with us, but whatever...
No, she did.
No,
it was an after the workshop.
That was in there.
Yeah.
And then the book later got reprinted by Berkeley Press in the States. But so I was on board as a partner for the publication of The Altered Eye. And from then on. And I think I had written a couple of stories, one of which was in that book. Irene Pagram did the cover, and she had done the cover of Electric Shepherd as well. And her cover for Electric Shepherd was fantastic. Her one for Altered Eye was not so good, unfortunately. It was... for maybe a printing economy, we only had two colours.
Only two colours. Yeah. So they're just grey and black.
But I found a little icon which we used inside the book of an eye sort of thing as the altered eye playing
on
EYI and I.
Yeah.
And in fact, bizarrely, the Berkeley edition published it as the altered eye, EYE, whereas it's the altered eye with this person, the eye being altered, not the vision. But in a way, both were being altered by the stories. Yeah.
So you actually got this, you actually had an agreement with a publishing house in the US.
And we sold it to them.
Sold it to them.
Yeah.
And largely because of Ursula, basically.
Yeah, right. Because she had Ursula's name on it.
Yeah, yeah. And she really liked our edition and said, look, this should have wider things. So she went to her publisher and said, look, you must publish this. And they did, but they changed it slightly. They included her story, and there was an international workshop between the members, Ursula and all of them.
That's right. Yeah, yes, and that was in the second edition.
So the second edition was slightly different. It had this extra story from Ursula and the workshop experience, but the rest was the same. And we sold the rights and we got income from that. I'm not sure how much, $1,000, maybe $2,000. So
for those times, that really it was fantastic. Helped paid for all our economics. Debts we had left over from the first.
So you're on a bit of a roll here. You've got the second book that you've done is sort of starting to get a bit of traction, both in Australia and in the US.
And that book, because it didn't just have the stories, but also had description and processes, was a really good educational book for someone wanting to understand how to run a writer's workshop or how to be a writer. Mm. And I think a lot of people at the time made those sorts of comments to us, and I certainly heard them.
I'm pretty sure a lot sold to schools or to librarians or whatever, and people setting up writers' workshops.
What to do.
So did you sell out the second book?
We did eventually. Yeah. It was a good seller, but it took a number of years. But partly because of this, our next book was The View from the Edge. There was a second workshop held with Vonda McIntyre and Chris Priest.
Next year.
And George Turner.
And George Turner.
Yeah.
This collection was more like it's a straight short story collection. It was not like the Write Shop experience. It did sell, but not as well as the first one.
Yeah. And again, I helped George put that together. Right. Yeah.
And again, it did have some very good personal experience stories in it. Yes.
So how did that one come about? That was another workshop.
Well, another workshop was held. You know, we had the altered eye, and we were looking around for things to publish, and we thought this was an obvious, next book. Yeah. So that's how it came about.
We had a good set of stories that came out of the workshop, and I remember George going through all the different things and saying we should put these ones in and perhaps not those ones. Mm. And then I think I helped all the copy editing, what have you, all the... I've been working as an editor in the government department and all that sort of stuff, so I knew all about that.
Mm. And the other thing is that particular edition had an interesting cover. I think overall our covers have been pretty awful, partly.
That was a good cover.
That one, that was a really good one.
We'll talk about a few of the others later on.
Yeah. And that was partly financial reasons. It was always run on a shoestring, so we didn't have money for professional artists and stuff like this. The reason that was a good cover, I got my brother involved, who was a professional photographer. He came up with the idea, he created the thing. And I think it's probably our best cover of all our books.
One of the best,
okay.
I think you had a couple other good ones. Okay. But that was certainly a good one. Mm.
So you started with the idea that you're going to be publishing a lot of material, reprinting a lot of material from SFC.
So that got completely pushed aside.
Yes.
And that got pushed aside because of the way that the altered eye had come about?
I
think we then decided we're a small Australian SF publisher, and so we're going to publish science fiction, criticism, but try and get new stuff rather than just reprints out of SF commentary.
And I think also, from the economic point of view, we thought that fiction was more likely to turn an income than just critical work, because really, in Australia, it was such a sort of restricted, limited market.
Yes.
And we needed to get some funding. Mm. So I think with the Altered Eye, there were a few small investors.
There were.
Plus also, I think, did we get the Australia Grants Council?
Yeah, when did the Australia Council come? Because that was our basic fund.
We got several grants. I'm not sure the first one. I think it might have been Moon in the Ground. From memory.
So not for us, not,
I don't think for the Altered Eye.
Okay, so we had some investors.
Yeah.
We had investors and we had returns from the early Philip K. Dick edition.
Yeah. So View from the Edge was 1977, and there's a bit of a gap through we get to 1979, and we get to Moon in the Ground, the one you just mentioned, by Keith Antill.
Yeah. This is interesting, because that was the winner of the Mary Gilmore Award, and I think...
For an unpublished manuscript. We got a lot of newspaper coverage at the time, but of course no publisher took it up
because of science fiction.
Right. Keith Antill was known to be by standards of the time very left wing, so they didn't want to touch it either. And so there's this, and we knew that it was John Bankston did all the detective work on this. He found Keith Antle and the story of the writing of it and all the rest of it. So John had an address, so we got in touch with Keith Antle because he was over the moon, so to speak. But the book was finally going to get a publication.
Oh, okay. So this, in these days, of course, that the unpublished manuscript prizes in a lot of the state literary awards are snapped at by publishers straight away.
Before then.
This wasn't the case. This didn't happen here. And so poor old Keith, he wins a major award and then is left languishing without a publication deal until you guys turned up.
The Keith's other books, which weren't necessarily science fiction, though some of them were a bit futuristic, I think.
I've never seen any of his other books.
Haven't you?
No, I've never seen any of his other books.
I think I've read two others of his. Okay. But I think you're right, the reason he couldn't get a publisher because it was science fiction. And in those days, Australian publishers didn't publish science fiction.
No, wouldn't go near it. So again, we're now here into 1979.
Yes.
4 years past AussieCon, almost 5 years past when you first started. And you're still the only one publishing science fiction around?
No, because at the exact same time as we started, Paul Collins came down from Queensland and started Corey and Collins. He and Rowena Corey set up down in St Kilda, and of course it was all set up so that they were supposed to be our deadly rivals, whereas in fact we did stuff for each other all the way through. Okay. We're always best of friends. But
in fact, they came out of Port Adelaide magazine called Void.
Yeah, that's right, Void magazine.
And so his initial company was Void Publications, and I think his first collection was published as by Void, but then later on they changed the name to Corey and Collins to recognise Rowena, who was his partner, and of course she's gone on to be a very successful writer in her own right as well, as indeed has Paul. And Paul now runs his own publication house as which is done extremely well. As a small press.
But we were first by a few months. Around the same time.
So you're rolling along with Moon in the Ground. That comes out. How does it sell?
I can't remember. I mean, can you remember?
I think it made us money back, didn't it?
It did. It was a slow seller. I think we had initial good sales and then it sort of slowed down a bit, but it sold regularly over a number of years. The cover again wasn't the best cover. It was by
Stephen Campbell.
Not one of our great covers.
He was developing his talent.
Yeah, but it did sell.
Yeah.
As part of our cost management, the typesetting was done by Bruce.
After about 78, when we bought the IBM Selectric Composer.
And so, and then Bruce was doing some typesetting for people like Henry.
For Highland House, I did about 8 books, 10 books for them.
And that really made a difference financially.
Us doing this in a way helped Bruce get other business as a typesetter.
And also, what I was doing,
he's also now a typesetter.
I was also editing the books while I typed them. We didn't tell anyone.
And it made our books more financially feasible because we didn't have to employ an external typesetter. We could do it in house. Yeah. Even though we're paying Bruce, it was still a cheaper rate than if we.
So what were you doing with sales for these books? How were you distributing the books?
We had a distributor. There used to be distributors for small press.
And one of our problems was our distributor went under at one stage, and I think we might have lost some of our stock.
I think we did lost a little bit. All Books were based in Sydney, and they specialised in small presses, so we fit in quite well.
But you were living in Sydney,
Let's go back a bit. I was, for about a year and a half, the Australia Press was located in Sydney, 1979-1980. I moved to Sydney and took... that's an interesting story. I took the whole stock with me. So right from the start, our warehouse was my garage or my flat or wherever I was living. For various reasons, I decided I'm going to go to Sydney in 1979. At the time, there was what we call magic pudding removals. It was basically Don Ashby, and he would hire a van and he'd get a couple of friends and we'd move people around Melbourne. He actually moved me and my stock from Melbourne to Sydney. We'd done a cost-benefit thing and really, he was willing to do it and hire the van and petrol, stuff like that, was cheaper than paying commercial freight. So we moved, 2,000 copies, a van full of books went from Melbourne to Sydney. And basically, I spent a year and a half in Sydney running Australia Press from Sydney.
Okay.
Because we should also say that in some ways, I'd say Bruce was the key editorial influence on everything, but Kerry was the business brain behind everything.
Oh, yeah.
He made sure everything happened, and that we covered our costs and we did returns and all the different things that we had to do.
Well, the point is that the frequency of these books have very much decided when we can get back money on the previous one and raise enough money, including Australia Council grants and whatever, to do the next one. You just couldn't go ahead of that because you'd be broke. And Kerry was a miracle, was making sure we never actually went broke. Mm.
Well done.
Yes.
Well, yeah, applying for the grants and making sure the sales happened as we're working with distributors and doing direct sales to bookshops.
Yeah. He's done this on a few other major conventions as well, let me tell you, as you're probably well aware. Yeah. So everything ticking on pretty well in the late 70s.
Well, one thing that happened after The Opera Eye and Pygmy Moon in the Ground was we then started getting a whole lot of submissions from writers wanting to have their books published. Mm. And so we'd have a slush pile and we each would read different manuscripts. And then we'd say, well, no, but what do you think this one?
Yeah.
And so we had a few maybes.
Mm.
And that's where I think... we had Damien's book.
No, it didn't come out of the slush because Damien's book had already... It already appeared in America, and then he suggested we do it in Australia, do an Australian edition. And
had it appeared or had he sold it?
That's what I can't remember. I can't remember whether it came out about the same time. But the trouble with that is we had to buy it back from Dave Hartwell, where we were at Timescape Books. And that, so we were down a couple of $1,000s before we even started, which meant that it was financially it was...
This is the Dreaming Dragons.
Yes.
Yeah, well, that sort of jumps us... Well, it's into 1980, but I've got a note here that Rob edited an anthology called Transmutation.
Yes.
Now, there's a bit of a contention about this one in terms of whether this really is a publication of this particular press or maybe another one.
Tell us
the story about this.
I think we've got agreement that I would edit a collection of new Australian stories. And I was talking to Maurice Schwartz, who ran at that stage Outback Press. He now runs Black Ink. And he decided he'd publish it in association with Australia Press. But in fact, Australia Press didn't need to put any money in.
Yes.
But he took the original stuff that I had already collected and then encouraged me to get other people. And he funded the whole thing. So that when you look at the printed copy, which is a hardback, it says on the wherever the imprint page is, Outback Press in association with Australia Press. So we had a bit of a Guernsey there, but it was fundamentally an Outback Press book, and that was included the story of David Briggs.
Yeah, sorry, minding that, yeah.
Well, again,
a very good story of yours, actually.
It's a superb collection.
And a story of Bruce's.
Mm. I remember it was about the only decent thing Randall Flynn ever, I mean, apart from his story. It was a very good Randall Flynn.
I found my editing experience really a productive thing because... David's story, for example, I remember suggesting, look, if you bring in a particular thing that you mentioned later on as a signal early on, and when it does happen at all, and David said, and he changed the story around. Mm. With Randall, he didn't want me to use a particular obscenity in the thing, and I ignored that because it was such a powerful thing. So for a few years, he was really angry with me. Another writers like David King, one of his stories was in it, and that went through about 5 iterations before it was publishable. Yeah. But you could see that there was the
good story
there. And I worked with, I think Philippa Madden had a story there.
Yeah.
Patrina Smith, she was at the Writers' Workshop, she had a story in.
She had a brilliant story in the Writers' Workshop collection,
So that's Transmutations, 1979. So we moved into 1980. Mm. And you've got 3 publications in this year.
Mm.
Stellar Gauge, which is an anthology edited by Michael Tolley and Kirpal Singh. The Dreaming Dragons, which we had previously mentioned, a novel by Damien Broderick. And a strange little collection of poetry, from Roger Zelazny.
Yeah.
Where Pussy Willow's in the cat yard.
Last one, cat yard.
How did that one come about? Was that because of him being in Melbourne in, was it 78 for Unicorn 4?
Did you meet up with him then to talk about it, or was it...
Can you remember how it
came I'm not sure how... It was related to him being in Australia at the convention. I remember that, but I'm not sure how we actually got to publish it.
I mean, he must have submitted it to us, and then we... It actually is a beautifully designed book as well, so... Just I can't recall.
Was there any demand for that internationally now?
Oh, there would be now. I mean,
yeah. I've got about half a dozen copies.
Yeah, Emily, it's not in any of the... If you whisper it around, people will just stagger. Zelazny fans, it's just not in any of the catalogues. And especially the hardback, which we still obviously got a few copies.
So, yeah. Probably sell for $1,000.
Well, you can probably do all right. Yeah. You can probably fund your retirement on things like this. If you've got things
what
right
about
around.
Stella Gage, Bruce?
Well, it was an utter failure. I mean, the thing is, I finally got around to my wish to do a superb anthology of critical stuff with all the top people. We had Aulis, we had Chris Priest, we had Michael Tolley himself, all sorts of superb people, and it just wouldn't sell because I don't know whether it wasn't distributed or whatever, but it just
died.
Fell dead to the ground.
Yeah. I think it will publish today with his academic courses and science fiction.
It would make a difference.
I had them in America, but we couldn't get it over to America. The thing is, if we'd had an American... See, we were trying to do particularly Advent publisher type thing, but they had
back in 1980, even in America, there were only a few courses.
No, they had 1,000 science fiction courses by 1970, I was told, but over and over again.
By 1970?
There were a huge number of college courses in SF set up in the 60s, mainly through the extrapolation bloke. His name is Clarison. Thomas Clarison was a term.
But if you look back at Ursula Le Guin's Guest of Honor speech, she actually talks about that trend in America of it becoming adopted by academia seriously in the United States.
This is the Guest of Honor speech you have on 75.
There's quite a bit in there about that.
Yeah. Which is available up on YouTube, I believe.
It's on our podcast, one of our podcasts.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yeah. I'll look up the episode and put it in the show notes. I cleaned it up and put it in the podcast.
So how did the... we spoke a bit about the publication history of the Damien Broderick novel. How did that one go? Did you...
That sold well, I think.
It did sell well.
Well, it had a very nice Grant Gittes cover, a very good cover, and we did it as a hardback, but at a decent price. I mean, people are already hardbacks getting beyond people's willingness.
And I think we sold paperback rights to Penguin, didn't we, for that?
That's right. Yeah. That's how we made our... We had to buy it back from America, but we sold our rights to Penguin in Australia.
Well, we licensed the paperback rights,
the paperback rights. Yeah.
Okay. And it won a major award, did it? Did it win a major award in America?
Of course it did. It either came first or second in the Campbell,
Award.
Campbell Award.
And later on it was listed as one of the top 100...
David Pringle's collection. It's one of those books that just keeps on travelling.
A bit of a sleeper, but still there. So
and if you reread it today, it holds up extremely well. It's a very good. I think it's one of Damien's best books.
Mm. Okay. Yeah.
Moving then to 1982, Lavington Pugh.
This is actually the first book
from our slush fund.
From our slush fund, because what we would get is these manuscripts, which looked literally smelled as if they'd been at the bottom drawer for many years, probably occupied by mice as well. Either that or they're absolutely stinking of tobacco smoke. And they'd obviously been around. They'd been around for umpteen publishers. They thought, this is a last ditch. We just, there's no quality there for several. I mean, it's not like today. As soon as you suggest that you put up your flag, you get vast numbers of manuscripts.
No, I wouldn't say that. Jay Bland's manuscript was there, but most of the other ones they were really unusable.
Yeah. Well, Jay Bland's was one that just stood out because that's the point. It was properly presented, and it was this book. Very nice style, really humorous style. And it was just the sort of satire combination of SF and satire on current. Adelaide, actually, Jay Bland. He and his wife actually visited us at. In Collingwood, and very very pleasant place.
So this slush pile you had, how big was it, and where was most of the material coming from?
Well, just people all over Australia.
So it was Australian stuff.
That's the thing. No, we didn't get any American or English.
But the cover of Lavington Pugh was interesting because we decided that part of to improve the marketability of our books was to go more professional with the cover design.
And we did.
And we commissioned a commercial artist who did book
covers.
Well,
it was a friend of Cosolino.
Mimo Cosolino.
Who I know,
ran a graphic design business. So
yeah.
He produced a really good cover.
Yeah, he's a real designer.
Now, that book would have sold 10 times more if we'd gone with his first cover. But unfortunately, Elaine didn't like it because she thought it was sexist.
The reason Elaine had a say in it is she was a very strong part of the production team, because when I would do the books on the the IBM Composer, what you turned out is just single sheets of with typesetting, and they still had to be pasted down, and Elaine did all the paste-ups for about five or six of these books. And
I was outvoted 2-1 on that one. My commercial... marketing sense said that would have really got people to start picking the thing up.
Yeah. What is this? I've completely forgotten that company.
And it was actually a good book. But it didn't sell badly, but it just didn't sell as well as we would have hoped.
Were you getting reviewed by any of the major papers?
Well, the main difference between this era and ours is that Stuart Sayers at the age was so in favour of new publishers and whatever, he made sure we got a review of every one of those books except one. And the only one we didn't was Unusual Angle for some reason. But we got reviews in The Age. We always got one in the Sydney Morning Herald, often in the Western Australian paper, all over Australia. If we sent them out to the newspapers, or of course we always got one in Australian Book Review, because at that stage it was committed to reviewing every single Australian book sent to it. And we ended up with at least five or six reviews in good venues.
I think there's still a Gashcott review though, did it?
Can't remember. You're probably right.
But not in any of the mainstream.
I ran an article in SF Comedy, but that's different. We didn't get...
And probably not the Rogers and Zelazny either.
I don't think we even would have sent... That we regarded that was going to do well in America if the news got around. So
The Leamington Pew, same year that you published The Plains by...
Yes.
Yeah, that's a really good story, and thanks to Bruce, really, and his relationship with...
Well, Jared. Let's see. We'll go back to 1977, which is the worst year until this year financially I ever had, living on nothing. But in those days, Gerald handwrote his manuscripts, and then a couple of them I typed. So I typed this huge 120,000-word novel called The Only Adam, which wasn't a novel. It was actually six novellas, the last of which is the piece that eventually became The Plains. And I said to him at the time, well, it doesn't fit in with the rest, and he wouldn't take... He tried to sell it. He really thought his career was over because he could not sell that 120,000-word... novelties. He sent it around, so it went quiet. And I, every year, I'd sort of suggest, come on, let's do The Plains as a separate book. And eventually, he gave. And then I showed it to both Kerry and Rob, and they agreed. Yes, it'd be a very good. It'd be 20,000 words. You'd set it so that it looked like a novel. It came out to about 120 pages if you typeset it the right way. And off we went. And we did have problems with the cover.
The cover is, for those people that haven't seen it, is mainly blue with white text on the front, and that's pretty much it.
No, that's the second cover.
That's the second?
That's the one that I've got.
The first cover had an image of a man in silhouette, and it was trying to sort of create something relevant to the book itself, but as a cover, it was a real failure. And we went ahead and produced it with the cover, and then we got so much negative reaction, we actually went and...
Well, the distributor said, we will not distribute it with this cover.
So we redid a plain cover, which is the words.
Had a week to do it.
Yeah.
So this was a hardback. So it's a dust jacket we're talking about. Didn't have to reprint the book.
We had to replace the dust jackets, yes.
And the second one was very much better than the first.
The previous one was unreadable. This was the point. We had commissioned an artist who we got recommended. And of course, when a professional artist does a job and you've paid her, then we felt we had to accept it, but it was just wrong. It was completely...
Okay. But in any case, with the... Gerald remembers the first cover, and I don't think he remembers the second one.
Mm. No, I don't think he's ever seen that first one.
No, because he makes very savage comments about it in ABR.
Oh, right, okay, ago. Right, yep.
But the revised one, it actually sold well as a book.
Yeah.
It got rave reviews.
Mm.
We sold the paperback rights to Penguin again.
Mm. And, of course, it got on the Age Book of the Year award.
I think it's a phenomenal book. Mm. Yeah. It's just wonderful. Mm.
Yeah. And that Gerald's
book is saying now that it
restarted his career because he was noticed and completely different from the first two books. Mm. And
it must be really weird, thinking back on it 40 years ago, 1980, 82, 38 years ago, is that we commissioned Mimmo Cozzolini for Lavington Pugh, but we didn't use him for The Plains.
I'm not sure why we didn't.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I can't remember now who did it.
No, it was
a terrible thing, and because we had a very small budget, we already paid, we thought we had to go with it, and that was a big mistake.
Yeah,
well, these things happen with small presses, don't they? That, you're really living off the smell of an oily rag, and everything is basically, you have to do what you do.
Mm.
And sometimes mistakes are made, and unfortunately, because you're living sort of from one book to the next.
But what would have it was nominated for Age Book of the Year novel, and we went along to the ceremony, and of course it didn't win. I still cannot remember, it's completely wiped from my memory what won. But anyway, Rosemary Dobson came over to, she was one of the three judges. She said, two of us desperately wanted this book to win, and one of us utterly vetoed it. Utterly vetoed it. And but if we had won, we would have had to immediately reprint at least 10,000 copies, and we didn't have the money
to do it.
It would have been a financial disaster for at least 4 or 5 months.
We would have found it.
So that's how, and that's the nearest Gerald came to winning a major award for. For years, it's been just recently,
virtually ever since.
Yeah,
one form or another.
Yeah, that sold overseas. Yes.
Eventually, because
New York.
Yeah, Brazil did. See, it's been sold in America at least 4 different times. It's been an utter failure until the recent success that he's had in America.
Okay,
and his publisher now has, I think, did 6 or 8 books, or virtually all at once. And got rave reviews. He got J.M. Curtsey to do the review of the New York Times.
Oh, there you are.
Yeah.
And this also raises another issue about the nature of our publishing company.
Yeah,
we were very much for the writer. We weren't seeing ourselves as trying to make a huge amount of money out of writers.
Mm-hmm.
If we knew then what we know now, we probably would have handled the whole rights thing a lot better, so that when we sold rights to Gerald's book, for example, we would have kept a royalty fragment in, as every other publisher does.
Mm. Yep.
But in fact, I think we gave the whole thing back to Gerald. But so it meant that none of these later successes had any impact on Australia Press, where almost any other significant publisher would always have had that.
Yeah, we would have got.
And the same with the Dreaming Dragons and with
the other ones.
Yeah, I mean, and also Penguin. Kept it in print for at least 20 years.
Mm.
And then, of course, then it was done by somebody else. And then, of course, the.
Text Publishing.
Not
Haywood.
Yes.
But the interesting thing there is, even though Penguin were reprinting it for 20 years, they weren't giving us the normal 20% of the publisher who licensed the paperhouse to we didn't get any of that.
Mm. Yeah,
because we'd be generous souls, gave it all to Gerald.
Mm. Yeah.
And that was probably a commercial mistake we made.
commercial mistake made at the time for the right reasons. Mm. Well, so you felt.
Well, can I interrupt a story I put in my account, which is up on the internet or whatever, but we were talking at a Society of Editors meetings with Nick Hudson, who was a later small publisher after he left the main publisher he was working for and was very successful, Nicholas Hudson Publishing. But he said, a bestseller is not the cream on the cake. It's the cake. It pays for your office staff. It pays for all your salaries. You have to have at least one bestseller a year or you cannot survive as a publisher.
Yeah.
And that's what we never had, it was a genuine, 20,000, 30,000 copy bestsellers.
Yeah.
So the planes ticked off, did well.
Yeah.
Yes. And then, so DreamWorks, another anthology, this time edited by David King.
Yes, yeah. Was it his idea?
I'm not sure.
I know he gathered some superb,
material.
And Kerry's mother, who worked in publicity, did our first real launch.
Launch, that's right. I remember
that. At the planetarium.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So I don't know whether it sold us any copies.
But, were these stories that David King had commissioned himself, or had you done them and handed them to him?
Oh, no, he did all the hard work of the authors he wanted to go for.
Right? So this was a sort of a complete package that he presented to you. Here all is.
Because he'd already done one for the Blackfords for their Ebony Books, which was an excellent collection.
It was actually a collection of very good writing.
Now he's changed his name and he's Daniel King and he's Professor of Philosophy at one of the Western Australian universities.
Well, okay. So then we move to, West Australian, a young Western Australian author.
And again, that's a genuine out of the slush pile, just suddenly sitting there and you thought...
But there's a difference that he'd sent us, I think, 3 or 4 novels, and all of them, we read them, the three of us, and each of them has some interesting things in them, and we send them back with some suggestions, and instead of reworking, he'd sent another manuscript. Then finally, he sent us An Unusual Angle, which was publishable.
Hmm. So we're here.
See, I remember Unusual Angle was the first one, and then he sent us the updated novels and books of short stories. And
we're talking here of Greg Egan, who, as I said, has gone on to bigger and better things and won major awards in the field. But this was his first published.
Yes, but he wrote it when he was 17. It's just so stylish and brilliant. You know? But you've got to ask Julian Warner about it, who went to school with him, and just how brilliant he was. I mean, he was the top math student.
But the other novels he wrote clearly also was 17 or 16 or maybe 15. I don't know when how old he was.
Oh, right, yes. Yeah, these enormous novels.
The ones that never got published. And you could tell this guy is very interesting, but...
Hmm.
They weren't working as novels.
They were all over the place.
I remember sending back copious notes back to him saying, if you can do this, you'll get it. He obviously moved on to the next thing he was doing rather than go back to it.
Okay.
Well, he was upset at us because we didn't publish any of those, but I eventually sent it. I said, look, this is not work. The only way you're going to break through overseas is to publish some short stories first. And what he did, of course, he sent the story to Interzone, and that was immediately accepted. And after a few stories in Interzone, then Carolyn Oakley from She's a Millennium Book said, you've got to do us a novel. So most people think that Quarantine is his first novel. And
it's not.
For years and years, nobody even knew about Unusual Angle. Mm-hmm. It took quite a while. But yeah. Oh, there's the rain at last, yeah.
That's the Egan book.
Yes.
And then we do George Turner's autobiography.
Yes, well, this is, again, there's a story to this. Everything goes back to 1970, so it's one of those years that I thought was a completely bung year, and all sorts of things came out of. So it's made me think.
1984, in the heart or in the head, autobiography.
Well, this goes back
George
to 1977. In 1977, George would write for any fans. I mean, people forget his absolute generosity. And he wrote this huge thing. He started writing everything he thought about what science fiction should be. And he did it in 3 or 4 parts. And it appeared in Yggdrasil, which was his tiny magazine done by the Melbourne University SF Association.
Anyway, so let's go back. So in 1977.
Well, okay, these articles were written. And the idea was we might make a book out of it. But it just sort of didn't happen. And then what did George do? He just developed an idea. That's right, he became very interested in the future in a way he never had before, and he became very concerned. And so he started this thing of connecting his biography with science fiction. And eventually, by 1984, he produced this wonderful... But it was all out of the same process by which he was writing The Sea and Summer, which again was his... You know, this is the future. We've got to pay attention to this. And he sort of had a new purpose in writing.
So this was climate change science fiction.
Yeah, that's
way back before
early 80s.
Because the last chapter of In the Heart or In the Head is all about possibilities, especially about climate change. Mm. And out of that came, of course, as I say, the Sea and Summer.
Which won several awards. Yes, one of the Arthur C. Clarke Awards.
That's amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
But the only two books in science fiction about climate change in the early 80s were George's book and Brian Orser's Pelicanus series.
Mm. We can have a big discussion about climate fiction at some point. Mm. Because have you read The Road to Corlay by Richard Cowper?
Which is
set in the year 3000, where Great Britain has been split into six different kingdoms because it's been flooded by rising sea levels. Yes. Climate change. 1976.
And even earlier than that, Keith Roberts, some of his stories were
and,
set on
Lathe of Heaven. Yes. Le Guin's got a throwaway comment early in the book in one paragraph about the settlements in Antarctica because it's all no longer frozen.
Mm.
So there's a lot of them around.
Yeah.
I just keep finding them all the time and I just keep, what? Yes. Where did this come from? Well, there's just these little bits in the background.
Well, the only thing that George really got wrong is he has the gradually rising seas and winters disappearing, but he didn't factor in dramatic weather changes. Mm. And if he built that in, he would have had a whole extra element, that which
brings us back to the weather conversations that we've been having on this podcast and elsewhere since then. So how did that one go? Did that one get much of a...
Well, again, in this book, Bruce has given a bit of history about how it came to be. It ended up being a really well-written, fascinating book about, because George's subtitle was An Essay in Time Travel. Yes. So he's looking at his life, not just as remembering, but trying to put it in a sense of different parts of his being. And the title comes from Shakespeare, I think, doesn't it? In the Heart and in the Head?
Yeah, it does.
And I remember unsuccessfully arguing we should call it The Heart or The Head to make it easier for people to say. But George was adamant that it had to be in the
Heart. No, he knew what he was doing.
And I think it would have sold better if it had been a shorter thing, The Heart or The Head, because when you, as someone, typical person going to the bookshop, they won't necessarily know Shakespeare, and they won't know the quote, even though I think that the full quote's on the title page. But it sold, but...
Well, certainly got good reviews, this is the point. I mean, getting reviews still then was important, and... I'd have to dig out all the reviews. I've got a complete.
Well, George was known out in the mainstream literary field because he won the Miles Frankel Award earlier on, and so he was a known figure.
And some of his son had done extremely well.
Some of the others, like Greg Egan, of course, but his first novel wasn't known. Probably people, as you said about the book, are probably kicking themselves now they didn't recognise it at the time.
Well, the only review I've dug up when I was looking is Sister Veronica Brady in a Western Australian newspaper. Did a superb, very favourable.
Of the Egan book?
Of the Greg Egan.
Yeah, right. I think she sold not too badly, too,
Well, it's a good cover again.
And you had further...
In fact, we used Mimo again on that one, didn't we?
Yes.
So we'd learned from our embarrassment with the plays. Mm.
So how were you all thinking about the publishing house at this point? Because we're almost near the end of the publishing history. We've got one more to go with Landscape, another Manet novel that came out. You've been running for touch on 10 years?
Yeah. Everything. Carey was never paid for his efforts.
No, but that wasn't the point.
Yeah, no, the point was that suddenly he discovered a new hobby, was getting married. and it led to the great quote when I was visiting, when Carey and Joe were in a flat, and the entire garage is full of North Australia Press books, and she came out and said, I only married him for his junk.
May have been a factor in why we stopped, but in fact, it was financial. I think the Australia Council system changed.
They were changing their system completely.
So we couldn't get the support that was critical to getting new books done.
And in fact, In the Heart or In the Head was one of only 10 books, it was a very small number of books of non-fiction books which actually got a grant that year. Mm. And the only reason is that I'd met somewhere, a launch, my old tutor, Denny O'Hearn, who remembered exactly who I was and very interested in what I was doing, and he wrote a page recommendation. And we sent that into the... and we, that gave us that seed capital to do In the Hunter and the Head.
But Gerald, because the planes had done well and gone to Penguin, he then brought us his next manuscript, which was Landscape of Landscape, which we were delighted to get.
Yes,
it's
yes.
Another beautiful book of his.
Yeah.
And a much better cover we put on that.
When Penguin did The Plains, they got this artist, David Wong, to do a much better cover than ours. I mean, really. And so we went, well, why not go to the same artist? Yeah. And again, he did a superb cover for the the hardback.
And so that sold well too, and had good, very good reviews.
Well, it didn't. This is what our dispute with Gerald is. Saying, well, it's only sold a few hundred copies, and I don't think he realised that... it takes a long while to sell
I think at the same time we had distribution problems too.
Oh, of course, the distributors were going down. Mm.
So we had no... At one stage we were using whoever distributed Penguin for the last two or three books.
Yeah.
But then that fell through as well. Yeah. And so the lack of the Australia Council, the lack of distribution meant we decided we've not made any money over 10 years. We've covered our costs.
Mm. Yes.
But...
hadn't lost any, but we hadn't
made it. And we needed to actually have an investment to do the next book.
Yeah,
we hadn't
made
the returns that we justified it.
Yeah.
I think that's why we decided to pull the plug.
Well, the main reason is the Down Deep scandal was the fact that Terry Dowling...
That was going to be our next book.
Yeah, and Terry Dowling did this huge amount of work. Harlan Ellison was going to do his thing, but of course he'd already... The Last Dangerous Vision is already 20 years in the past. Mm. I mean, why Terry Dowling trusted him anyway. Of course, nothing happened.
Hmm.
But Harlan Ellison just did not do anything, and Terry was left there, and we were left with the book we really wanted to do. Yeah,
yeah. So, just to give a bit of background, if Helen had delivered,
yes, that would
our latest book would have been edited by Harlan Ellison and Terry Dowling, and that may well have sold enough money, enough copies for us to get the money to do another book.
Well, we certainly could have sold it,
and then it could just have kept on rolling.
We could have sold it in America.
So that was the other issue that confronted us. That was like a perfect storm of these three or four different things.
It didn't happen.
Yeah,
Kerry getting married is probably the most important. But I don't think that was really good.
Yeah, so Down Deep ended up becoming a sort of an Antipodean version of Last Dangerous.
Yeah, that's right.
Because the effort that, you know, when George died and left me the Lintry estate, the effort that, therefore I inherited Cherry Weiner as my agent, the effort she had to take for about a year and a half to get George's last story out of, which he'd sold to Down Deep, getting back from Harlan Ellison was just an epic. He just wanted to keep the things tucked around him.
Yeah, that was the same story as Last Dangerous Visions, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes.
He wouldn't let people have the stories back.
No, he still hasn't.
No, there's still a lot of them that's still floating there.
And Limbo.
I have no idea what's going to be happening to them now that he's passed on.
Yeah.
And then Jack Dan got his story back. It has been republished recently.
I think there have been a few others that were in that collection that have got their stories back and moved them on.
But some writers, apparently, the only copy was with Harlan instead of the story
altogether. That's right, that was the problem.
Mm. Mm, that isn't good.
Unless it ends up in his papers somewhere.
Mm.
Well, they're there. I mean, I've heard reports on the internet that they're all sitting there. Just nobody really knows what to do with them.
Somebody's just got to basically pick it up.
Yeah, I just don't know what the situation is with his literary executive, that's all.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's bizarre, I think, the psychology paralysed him not being able to do those two books because they would have enhanced his reputation.
Sure,
it would have helped us. It would have helped the writers.
Yeah,
yes.
It would have helped science fiction generally.
Yeah.
So that was going to be the next one, and it just didn't occur.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
well, the change. I don't know what was happening in your life. In my life, I'd had a rough year for a rough couple of years for freelance editing, and I rang up Brian McCurdy at Macmillan, and I asked him for a reference for a job, you know, me apply for a job. He said, why are you applying for a job? We've got all this work here. I said, I have not had a job from Macmillan for a couple of months. He said, I think we'll do something about that. And he offered me this extraordinary thing of guaranteed freelance work, which went on for 12 years. But it meant that I had 12 years of by far the most work. from 84 onwards. Mm. So I didn't do any, I did hardly any fanzines from then for about 5 years, because I just had so much work for Macmillan. So that was what was happening in my life.
Yeah. Mm.
And what was happening? Well, you were getting married.
I got married.
It was a couple of years after that. I was involved in other things, sort of working for my brother initially. Yeah. So I think
we all got very busy.
We got busy. The three of us were busy doing other things, both professionally and personally. So
looking back on it now, do you look back on it as a fondly, as something that you enjoyed doing at the time?
Absolutely.
My feeling was always to do books that nobody else in regular Australian publishing would touch, and I think we kept pretty much to that, and they've all sort of gathered their own momentum in years afterwards, even if it hasn't been much profit to us. But
I think you should be very proud of
it. I'm proud of what we did.
Yeah, for sure.
Do you see the press as having had an influence on the wider Australian field?
Of course, because they're next to the person who specifically wanted to emulate what we were doing is Peter McNamara, who started in 85, with the magazine, and then publishing all the books he's done, Fenian Books. So he was and then he leads directly. He's the mentor for the Western Australians, Jonathan Straw and Co., which started Eidolon Books, and Aureola starts in 91 in Melbourne. I mean, it's just sort of this handing on of the baton of a small press publishing. Mm.
That's one influence, an important one, that other people saw was possible.
Yes.
That's a really important thing. But I think another influence we had was we actually gave recognition to Australian SF writing in a way that would have been very difficult, and therefore we really helped writers in Australia to get heard and seen and read, and therefore get exposure internationally as well.
Because before we came along, there was no SF published by mainstream writers, or very little. So we came along and said, look, this is something that's worth doing, and we published books, collections. Definitely.
I mean, the only other thing was Lee Harding's superb collections he did during the 70s with Highland House. I can't remember their names, but anyway, they're excellent. One of them was a book of David Grigg had his...
Beyond Tomorrow.
Beyond Tomorrow,
that was my first published short story. And
is it Before the Other Eye?
Yes.
That
little story has done very well for me over the years. Actually, it got reprinted in one of John Joseph Adams' anthologies, and still get royalties for it.
It's good to see things keep on rolling.
See, Lee was basically trying to hit the overseas markets, but he did have these, thanks to Highland House. And Highland House, of course, did Displaced Person, with which he won the Australian Children's Book Award in 1980.
Marshall Award, wasn't it?
Yeah. So they, Al and Ann, they gave me a lot of work when I was doing the typesetting. Both died now, but a lot of people remember. Actually, the great thing of the annual Highland House parties, in which the one place you could meet really famous authors who were just relaxing, and you didn't have to, they're just enjoying themselves. It was really good.
I think we've just about come to the end. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your time this afternoon. It's been much appreciated.
The History of North Australia Press does have a print version, and it's in SF Commentary 98, which is the 50th anniversary edition, and that can be found at efanzines.com for download.
We trust you enjoy listening to our podcast. If so, we'd be grateful for your help. We'd love to get more listeners. So please let your friends know about the podcast. Reviewers on iTunes or Podchaser. Write about us on your blog. Spread the word on Facebook and Twitter. Collar total strangers in the street and tell them... maybe that's going a bit too far. But most of all, of course, please keep listening. We have lots more interviews and other great content planned. Thanks.